House Committee on Revenue for Monday, February 23rd, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go slightly out of order with our agenda by opening the work session on possible bill introduction. We have two of them today. We'll open the work session. Representative Bentz?
Chair, I move LC-3437 and LC-3708 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill or Ledge Council drafts 3437 and 3708 be introduced as committee bills. Colleagues, with the usual caveat that supporting this resolution, this motion does not commit anyone to take any particular action in connection with these bills. Is there any conversation, any discussion, any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Paul, we'll close the work session on introduction of committee bills. We just go in order, right? No reason not to. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2490. And Mazin will come and explain it all to us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2490, the one you've seen before. Let me refresh your memory. This is the one that was asked for by the state treasurer. And what it wanted to do is to clean up the language that talks about calculating the CPI in September 9th. You remember that September 9th date crept up into the statutes when they were cleaned for a different purpose last time around. And this puts back the date of calculation as August 31st, where it's consistent with the publication of the CPI.
Bravo. Okay, so the item is open for a motion.
Chair, I move the House Bill 2490 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2490 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? This one went by fairly quickly, but all it does is put a realistic date on an item that allows them to calculate things. Any opposition, any objection to the motion? Don't see any objection. The motion carries. Colleagues, is this one that should go on the consent calendar?
Yes.
Recognizing that those who object get to carry, the matter goes on the consent calendar. All right. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2490 and open a work session on House Bill 2493. Is that yours, Mazin?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair and...
Oh, court meetings, right.
Members of the committee, this is another one that comes through from the state treasurer. This is the one that last time you've heard it was explained about the process of the meetings for the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, the SIDPAC. When they meet about once a year rather than 6 months, and this tries to make the language consistent with that practice. There is a dash 2 amendment also in that you would find in OLIS, and the dash 2 amendment makes also a different change into the bill or into the language. The change comes that there is the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission is recommended to look at the 6 years forecast for the debt capacity, and this has probably made a little different with the time of where the forecasting process of DAS and the Office of Economic Analysis, where they are looking at a 10-year horizon at this time. And this amendment attempts to align this consistent with that forecast, so it will be a 10-year horizon rather than a 6-year horizon. That's what the Dash 2 amendment does, and it still is a no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Thank you. And this is proposed by the treasurer?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is the treasurer here?
The treasurer is here.
Yes, please. I think I know what this is about, but some of the members of the committee probably don't.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Drew Johnston, legislative director for the state treasurer and the state treasury. This amendment was discussed when we had the committee hearing. It was just to, if we're going to fix how current practice lines up with how we do it in statute, we might as well do the date change as well as the date with which we look at how many years out. So we just want to connect it with the Office of Economic Analysis, which looks out 10 years. Statute is not quite in accordance with that.
So the effect of this would be to conform us to current practice.
Correct.
In effect.
And if they change, you know, however long they want to look, you know, really what we're trying to do is go off of what OEA does. And so if they look at a shorter time frame, this amendment would allow us not to have to come back and make a minor change again. So
okay. You're actually looking at 10 years out, aren't you?
Yes, yeah. But should in the future there be any change in how far we look out the economic analysis?
Right. Okay, Representative Vance.
Drew, I don't know if you've been there long enough in the treasurer's office to see, tell us this or not, but the so-called long term or the 10-year period, as compared to the six, I guess the issue is, do we need to be looking at a shorter time frame, or is it just totally out of whack now, given the fact that everybody else is my assumption correct that everyone else is using a 10? Is that a correct management statement? I mean, I'm trying to figure out with whom are we coordinating by virtue of this amendment? That's the right question.
So, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, we're trying to coordinate with the Office of Economic Analysis. So previously, their forecast was a little bit shorter than what it is now. And we've, in the SDPAC reports, they've looked at that 10-year horizon. So this would just allow us to amend statute to match up with kind of what we're following is their lead. So when they come out with a analysis of forecast, we then do the debt analysis on that.
Okay. Representative Vance?
No, there's a question down there.
Oh, sorry. Representative,
I'm just concerned that 10 years out is too far. We can barely see into next year. And so for me, I don't think that I'm interested in going 10 years. I think what we're doing at six is sufficient because we're having a hard time understanding what we have in terms of revenue for next year. So I'm a no on this amendment.
Yeah. Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt said the amendment does not actually specify 10 years. The amendment only specifies that outlook would be consistent or will be built with what the Office of Economic Analysis does. The Office of Economic Analysis today, their practice is a 10 years because there is a 10-year window that the governor's budget and everything else looks at. It's a 10-year. But the 6-year, that was the old practice. And I think by saying in the language that we will be consistent with what the Office of Economic Analysis, DAS, basically comes up with, this will make the recommendation that you would find in 286A255 consistent with the rest of the state budget outlook, basically.
Right. And I think we ought to note that the amendment changes the term 6-year to long-term.
Right.
And, of course, that ends up being whatever works. I think I would agree with you if we were concerned, if we were convinced that the 10-year estimate was accurate. I don't think anybody believes that it's an accurate statement. What it does is give us a trend line. If you recall the testimony from the OEA people the other morning when we met with the Senate, they basically said that their trend line was simply that. It was a trend line. It wasn't an actual estimate, and that there were going to be recessions and really fast-growing periods in between. And if you look at their trend lines from the past, you see a random walk around the trend line, but it does move along the trend line. I don't know if that helps you or not. But
I understand what you're saying. I still don't want to make it so generalized.
Okay, great. Other comments, questions? You want to move that?
No, I'll move it.
Representative Benz?
Chair, I move the dash two amendments.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2493. Any further discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment?
Yeah.
I think there's one objection. I think we better take the roll.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. And with that, the motion carries. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2493 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2493 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the motion itself. Any objection to the motion, this motion? I think we'll take the roll again.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. And with that, the motion carries. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Reed will carry. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2493, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2488. Yes. Christine. Yes. James the Moonrider.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2488 has a dash one amendment there that does fill in the blanks for the amounts of income tax overstatement that would, and also corporate income tax overstatement that would trigger the overstatement penalty. The measure is found to have a minimal fiscal impact, and also a statement there of indeterminate revenue impact, because there are some different components of the bill that could affect revenue in different ways. On one hand, the measure could, by inflating to or indexing to inflation, the threshold for the penalty is considerably higher, and so this is found to potentially eliminate around 66% of the penalties incurred for personal income tax. It's on the corporate side, it's not as well known, but it could be a substantial reduction in the amount of penalties. However, on the other hand, the fact that the penalty now applies to an overstatement of net tax means that there's a broader range of cases in which the penalty could be incurred. So even though the thresholds were raised by indexing to inflation, it's also it could be that this penalty is applicable in more cases. I mentioned in the revenue impact statement, it's possible that this would even potentially offset the first impact of reducing the number of penalties. But House Bill 2488 does fill in an amount, and I'm trying to get to it. I believe it's $3,500 for the personal income tax or corporate income tax, and $4,400 for the corporate income tax, although I'm trying to scroll to it here. But.
If I'm reading the dash one, House 2488-1, and
yes.
What it looks to me as though it says is the first blank is filled with the number 2400,
okay.
And the second blank is filled with the number 3500. I think the first one has to do with personal, and the second one with corporate.
That is correct.
If you look at the old numbers, It looks to me as though we're talking about a substantial reduction in the number of people who are likely to be affected by it, because the tax number here is quite a bit less than, quite a bit higher than 10% of the old number that we were using based on the older system. And just a quick rough off the top of my head kind of connection is that it suggests that probably we drop a bunch of people off the bottom end, don't we? And I think that may have been what you said, too, I understood you correctly.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the impacts. the numbers there of 2,500 and 3,500 were obtained by looking at the income limit as it was in 1987, growing that forward by inflation to present day, and then translating that income using the average tax rate into how that would follow through to net tax, and that's where that number came from. So it does raise the threshold a little bit, quite a bit.
Thank you. All clear as mud? I understood this bill when we heard it. I think I still do. What's your pleasure? We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the
Representative
Benz. The -1 amendment. I'm just trying to find it. I think it is a -1 amendment.
Yeah, there is a -1.
Mm-hmm. It's a
-1. Yeah. Yes, the one with the 2,400 and 3,500.
Here it is.
Oh, there it is. Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2488.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2488, which inserts the term $2,400 in the blank on line 13 and $3,500 in the blank on line 16. Any discussion of that amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz.
Chair, I move House Bill 2488 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2488 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Is this one we should put on the consent calendar, or should we try to explain it?
We should try to explain it.
Who wants to do that? Representative Benz will carry. Thank you. I was hoping that was going to be the answer. Representative Benz will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2488 and open the work session on House Bill 2483. This is the one that we had the conversation about, isn't it, Representative Davis?
Indeed.
And I think you found a solution.
I think the department did.
The department found a solution.
Yes.
Well, we'll hope. Kyle?
Nice. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2483, we were discussing last Wednesday, the 18th, and there was some concern about the unit of property definition, which is in ORS 310-160. And we do have a -1 amendment that would adjust, it's up there on the screen, and it would make the unit of property as defined in 310-160 subsection 1. So that's the change there. And what that would do is it would limit a little bit of the definition of unit of property. So there's 5 subsections there, and this would only connect to the first of the subsections.
Okay. Representative Davis?
Would you like an explanation?
Mm-hmm. It would be nice to know if this fixes the problem you were concerned about or not.
It does. So to remind the committee, the problem, thank you, Chair, that I potentially identified, or maybe I was making a lot of hay out of nothing, was situations where a property account may have been appealed by a taxpayer, that account being part of a larger unit, and the accounts that make up that unit having separate ownership. And my concern was having an appeal by taxpayer A, the department or the assessor becomes involved, draws in the entire unit, and therefore draws in another owner, another taxpayer who had no intention of appealing or becoming involved in a tax proceeding. What the -1 amendment does is limit the definition of unit to ORS 310-160 sub 1, which requires, which defines unit as under common ownership. So, therefore, appeals of the department or assessors could only bring in those accounts that are under common ownership of the first account that was appealed.
Okay, thank you.
See if I got that right.
This deals with most of the problem you're concerned about, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And yes, it does deal with the vast majority of them. And so it was our thought that it was more important at this point to have wide support than to make sure every last scenario might be dealt with. And we thought also that if you know, a situation, you know, arose where they were being used inappropriately, we would just bring it back in some future session. But I did ask the assessor for Clackamas County to come down and help us with this, because this is something the counties work more with on a direct account-to-account basis. So,
thank you. Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor and the former president of the Assessors Association and the Tax Collectors Association. And I think Representative Davis explained it very clearly. What this does was limit the scope in an appeal situation where you have common ownership. I think it's a very appropriate resolution, and I think contributes to the fact that I think taxpayers, business owners, can have confidence that properties will be valued correctly at 100%, and it'll be done appropriately.
Thank you.
And I'll be happy to ask or answer any questions.
Any questions for these two? All right. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2483.
Representative Benz moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2483. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2483 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2483 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection to that motion? I don't see any, so the motion carries. Representative Davis, will you carry? Thank you. Representative Davis will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2483. That concludes our work sessions for today, doesn't it, Paul? I didn't skip any. Okay. So are we ready for a public hearing? I think we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2164. You're back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2164 would make permanent a pilot program that exists right now for some participating agencies to certify tax compliance prior to issuing some licenses. The measure would expand this requirement that Department of Revenue establish an automated method for certifying the compliance through a website. It provides for a phase-in of the system certifying tax compliance for licensees. It requires the state agencies, boards, or commissions with 5,000 or fewer licensees must certify that licensees comply by January 2nd, 2016. It would expand this requirement to for the certification to agencies, boards, and commissions with 25,000 or fewer licenses by January 2nd, 2017. And to all agencies, boards, and commissions by January 2nd, 2018. It also has an expansion over time of the compliance requirement initially to ORS Chapter 316, and then it would expand to Chapter 317, include Chapter 317 and 316 by 2019, and also to cigarette and tobacco taxes by January 2nd, 2020. So this is a bill that has come up almost annually for many sessions, but it refers to this pilot program that is currently operated whereby the Department of Revenue certifies tax compliance for agencies that request this information prior to issuing an occupational license.
Okay. Is the department ready to tell us how the pilot project has gone so far today? I mean, we have four new members, and before we ask them to approve a bill to extend it, they ought to at least know what we've been doing so far.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, and this is a bill that originated out of House Bill, I believe, 2009, House Bill 3082, and we initially started a compliance a pilot project with three agencies, the Mortuary Board, the Tax Practitioners Board, and the Construction Contractors Board. And there are several reports that we've provided to the legislature, which I can make available again, regarding the effectiveness of that program. We came back in 2013, I believe. There was a bill, 2464, I believe, asking for this the same thing. While we have some successes, and we do believe that this is a good thing to do, the licensee compliance, we at this time are working on a core system replacement, and it's something that our new system can do. And it's something that we can do in an automated way. It's just a matter of timing, and that's what we came back last session and said we asked for some grace on this project as far as it coming in line with that. And mainly because we want people who can self-certify, which is what this bill would do, is they would have to come onto our online system and they would have to come in and say, get a certificate. The look back right now would be coming from two sets of data. And so we're just cautious that maybe there would be some people that would get thrown out for noncompliance when they weren't really there. So we would like to continue to explore this option, but just give it a little bit more time as we get a little further along in our project. We do find that there is some value. The Tax Practitioner Board probably wasn't the best board to do as a pilot project because they had a very, very, very high compliance rate. We worked with the...
But there were still a few, weren't there?
There was a handful. And as a result of that, the director of that agency actually, I think, adopted rules that require compliance now for all practitioners at the board. So that's a standard that they now have just generally. So moving forward, yes, broadly, we need to understand what the makeup of the licensee population is in Oregon. Right now, there is a centralized place for reporting of licensees, but it's not very fleshed out. The agencies aren't, as far as I know, required to submit that information yet. So it's still kind of an unknown for us at a really high level. But overall, yes, we do think it's valuable because we do get some people to come into compliance when they otherwise aren't. Okay. That helps.
So to summarize, I think what you just said is this is a big bite, and we're not quite ready for it yet.
Mr. Chair, that would be a great summary.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. When do you think you do you know today when you would be ready?
Well, I do know that our Mr. Chair, our system can do this. We have checked with that with Gentax, and it's something that we can do. But my understanding is that they want the more accurate results would come when the information is native to that system and not just overlapping our current legacy system and that. So at least probably depending on how far back you want to look, we'd want to you know if you want to look at 3 years compliance, we'd probably want to have 3 years of live of data in there that's native to that system. If that does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how far back you want us to look.
I see. So it would be, if I understand you correctly, what you'd really like to do would be to start this project at the point at which you already have 3 years worth of information in your system.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct if that's how far back you want us to look. If it's just a 1 year look back, that's one thing. A 2 year look back, but a 3 year look back is, I believe, what this bill asks for.
Okay, great. Other questions for her? A whole bunch. Let's start on the end. Work this way, please.
So, thank you.
Smith Warner.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. So, I was not here during this. And because the language in this seems so ambiguous about agencies may do this, so you said that those three that are listed, that were listed as the pilot, or that you listed as the pilot mm-hmm. programs, did you require those three to do it is my first question, and then did any other licensing agencies kind of take you up on the opportunity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, we were able to go into an agreement with the agencies. So we looked for the pilot project, a small agency, a medium-sized agency, and a large agency, or number of issuances of licenses. And then after that phase, we went and entered into an information sharing program, which we called phase two, I believe. And it was, I think it was with the nursing board. There was a few, three more boards, I think, that we worked with to just share information with them about their licensing requirements. But the bill itself, the House Bill 3082, only allows us to enter into a contract or enter into this with three agencies to actually go forward and evaluate. Now, that evaluation going forward, we'll look to see, you know, for 2016 what happens there. But that those three agencies are the only ones we were required to, or that the law allowed us to enter into a contract with. The other three were voluntary, and they were just information sharing. They didn't suspend or request suspension or require anything of these people. Does that help?
Yes. Okay. And follow up?
Yes, please. Yes.
Quick follow-ups. Number one, looking through the numbers in there, I'm assuming those cutoffs are kind of because you have an idea of, like, first go to 5,000, which is X number of boards, and then to 25,000, the whatever year after that. I'm assuming that's because you kind of have a sense of capacity and building it up by the number of boards given those licensee sizes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, I actually am not aware of where these thresholds originate. Oh. This wasn't a bill we requested. It's just something I think that came up over time. And I think one of the recommendations in the past has been to phase it in, but I don't know what the origins of those numbers are.
Okay. Chair, is there... I guess we'd probably have to ask LC.
I think the implication of the question, if I could attempt this answer, would be to say that one of the things that I think we need before we would consider a bill like this for a work session would be a report on where we are in the past. We've had reports in the past about the size of the various licensing bodies in terms of numbers of licensees. We could have that report again, perhaps updated. And that would give us an idea of whether these are the correct numbers or whether we ought to substitute something else.
Okay.
I think the question about the date, about when it would start, is something that obviously is open to discussion. And then, of course, why this bill would propose certification and what other states have already done that and how it's worked. And I know that at least one other state is using that method or has used it in the past. And so those would be among the things that we'd want to consider. I thought we were going to get that report today, and obviously you didn't. So that's fine. We're not obviously going to work a bill like this until we've gotten that background.
And can I do one
please.
Final follow-up?
Go ahead, yeah.
So and to just follow up on what you said about the department would propose on, depending on the number of years you wanted as a look back, like waiting that long to get it in one system, would it be doable? Do you believe it would be doable for the department if we were to do this and say, you know, 1 year on the first one, then two, then three, so that we could start sooner rather than later, but up the look back distance over time, so that if we wanted to start this sooner than waiting for that number of years, is that something you think you would have the capacity to do with a new system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, yes, that is a doable thing. It's just a three-year look back. Currently, it crosses over two systems.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but if we wanted to make it another kind of another phased roll-in, perhaps.
My understanding is that the new system that it can do this automated look back, and we've gotten validation from the people that are the knowers of these things. So
it's not like you didn't know this might be coming.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going this way, and I think Representative Bence was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone over this way? Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Representative Bence.
This kind of builds on previous questions, but do you have a list of the occupations that will be covered by the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I do not have a list handy, but I can get one. I think there is a list, an agency, I believe it's through Secretary of State, that requires all of the agencies to list their licensees, and I think a bulk of them are occupational licenses. I do remember that there was some concern about the licenses through DMV, whether they would be occupational or not, the CDL licenses versus other licensing. There was some recollection about that last time, but we can get a list of occupational type licenses that we think, based on that list that's at Secretary of State now.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So the bill reads in line 12, the license for the privilege of engaging in an occupation or profession. I guess we could argue about privilege for a while, but and what the meaning of it is. But is there anybody that wouldn't be captured by that word that's got a license from the state?
Another question to
Mr. Chair, yeah, that would be a good question to try and answer. I don't know if a driver's license would be considered an occupational license. I think, I don't know all the licenses off the top of my head, but I imagine there's quite a few of them that would not fall into that category. I don't know.
Representative Vance, yes.
And I'm a little concerned about the, first of all, the number of people that will be caught up in this approach, and then the second is whether there would be timing elements or issues when it comes to having your taxes paid. So many people may be delayed in getting their taxes paid for whatever reason, and I just want to know if the systems are set up in such a fashion as to not inadvertently begin to have people's licenses to work suspended without possibly being in trouble. And I've forgotten, because we did this bill, what, 3 years ago, I think?
Six.
Yeah, but who counts?
We're having fun.
Yes. We think the last time we looked at this was 6 years ago?
No, that was the original bill.
The original bill. I thought we looked at it 2 years ago, too.
We have looked at it since then.
Yeah. I think the question is, what does the word compliance mean?
That's right.
I think that's what you're asking, isn't it? And I think that's something that, rather than have you kind of discuss it here, I think it makes a lot of sense for us to actually prepare a presentation, or for you to prepare a presentation in which you discuss what that word compliance means in a context like this. I mean, my recollection is it doesn't mean you've paid all your taxes. It may mean a whole lot of other things along the way. And since I'm on this side of this table still, I'm going to recognize Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that the original bill does answer some of those questions at the end of page one, I think, or was it page two? Towards the top of page two. Has a series of things listed that make up the answer to the question of whether someone is in compliance. Essentially, it means only the people who are not responding to the Department of Revenue. So someone who's appealing, someone who's on a payment plan, all of those things count as compliant.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. I think that's very helpful. Representative Vance?
No, Christian, thank you. Yeah. And for someone who hasn't been filing a tax return but is licensed, what happens there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, they would under this automated system, they would get a letter that it would say that they weren't in compliance. The letter would say that, and so they would contact us, and then we would investigate whether they had a filing requirement prior or not, and work with them to get the returns in the system if they did, and if not, then we can manually issue a certificate of compliance if they just moved here or something and they didn't have a filing requirement before.
Thanks a lot. That's Representative Whitson.
I think my questions may have been answered. I was wondering how many occupational licensing agencies and individuals do you anticipate being affected by this ultimately?
That's, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitson, that's something we'll find out. I know there's quite a few of them.
All right. I think... Any other questions? It looks to me like you have your work cut out. The department made an excellent presentation, I think, 2 years ago on this. And if you were simply expand on that, I think you would deal with all the questions that people asked, except perhaps the last one that Representative Bentz asked, which may take a little more thought. How do you deal with the person who just moved to town, has a brand-new minted degree and a new license, and has no tax history in Oregon because they haven't owed any taxes here before? And Representative Benson may have a different idea, too. Right. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, I did. I was thinking of those who perhaps don't earn enough to actually file.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who don't meet the threshold.
Right.
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 Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll call on, I have four witnesses signed up, and I'll just call them in the order. Bob Russell and Bill Perry, do you want to go first? And then on deck would be Sean Gilliams and Jan Meekums. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? As you can tell, we're not going to finish our hearings today. All right. Please, go ahead.
You want to go?
It's up to you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. And I think two of the questions up there probably is going to be the major factors for us on this bill is what is compliance and what is the privileged license. Obviously, not that I like to tell you exactly what goes on in our industry, but as well, you guys probably know, almost all servers underreport their tip income. So there was actually a report I can get to you, or an article that came out that said on average only 60% of tip income is reported to their employer annually. And so as a restaurant owner, I have to keep all these credit cards and everything so I can actually tell you how much money is probably owed to the government, but until it's reported, I'm not allowed to pay taxes or collect taxes on it. And so I would say almost all tipped employees are not compliant with their taxes in the state of Oregon. Now, they get a license or a permit or whatever you want to call it through both food handlers, through the Oregon Health Authority, and the alcohol servers permit through the OLCC. So if those are privileged license, that creates a huge issue in my industry. So obviously that would be a big deal if that falls into the privileged category. So without a proper definition, it has a big, big, big impact in our industry. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there are questions for the two of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. This bill first came up before Representative Barnhart was chair of this committee. Actually, it was when Tom Butler chaired this committee, which is before Representative Bentz came to the legislature. So it has been around for a long time. We have been having discussions about it for a long time, and it has been causing my industry concern for a long time. And there are currently 98,925 commercially licensed truck drivers in the state. Every time we've had this discussion, those folks are clearly included in the definition of license. So they would have to go out and garner proof of compliance before they could renew their license. Things have changed for us a bit in that the federal government has combined the medical requirements for truck drivers with their driver's license. So we used to have a separate medical card and we had a driver's license. Now the driver's license takes place of both. One of the things that happens to us is that a driver will go to the doctor and the doctor says you've got high blood pressure. And so I will give you a medical certificate for 3 months. So they have to go to DMV, they get their license issued for 3 months. Then they have to go back to their doctor, and they continue through that process. So it's not just every 4 years that a truck driver may have to renew their license. It may, in fact, be more frequent than that. Some of you may be aware, but probably most of you not, that I used to be a tax collector for the state of Oregon. I worked at the Public Utility Commission, and I was responsible for collecting the weight mile tax and truck registration fees. And sort of one of the basic premises that we followed in that program was the most efficient way to collect taxes is to focus your efforts on those that are clearly noncompliant and leave the compliant taxpayers alone. And believe me, you don't want to get calls from those people either. So what this program does is it brings in all the compliant taxpayers as well. And my recollection from the department's testimony last in 2013 was that the percentage of compliant taxpayers is well over 90%. So most of these folks, they really don't need to do this. And you can imagine sort of the hassles of getting it done. Having to go to a website and print it off. You can also imagine that somebody might figure out how to print something that looks like that. Because obviously you're putting this on a computer and a printer that you have at your home or whatever. It might be easy for somebody to fraudulently duplicate that. That could be an issue. This also provides another portal into Department of Revenue's computer, and I know the bill says that they have to protect the piracy or privacy of all the taxpayers, but you know, I personally was a victim of the Target and the Home Depot problems, and I know that in order to protect against those these days, it's very, very expensive. So I would really be cautious about that part. I would also point out that I believe that this bill, the way it's written, picks up corporate taxpayers. I believe that's Chapter 317 is the corporate portion. So it's not just individuals. And I would also point out an inconsistency in that on page 2, line 4, it says compliance with Section 2, Chapter of Oregon is required for licenses issued. So clearly that seems to me a requirement to the agencies is issuing licenses. And then you go back to page 3, section 6, line 18, and it says, before issuing or renewing a license described in this section, a state agency board or commission may require. So in one case, it seems to be a mandate. In another, it seems to be optional. So I recognize after the testimony of the department that you may need a little more work on this bill, and I'm going to stop there and be happy to come back at a later time.
Thank you very much. Questions for restaurants or truckers? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much. Sean and Jan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I feel I'm partially responsible for this since I was the one who wrote the bill with Representative Reed in 2009. As I joked earlier, I thought it'd be a two-year pilot project and go away, and lo and behold, 6 years later, we're still talking about it. So with that in mind, Mr. Chair, we do have a number of concerns with it. I think we had concerns originally. A few things that were raised today, the timing of renewal. Real estate licensees don't renew on a calendar year basis. They renew based on their birthday. So if they're somewhere in the middle of the tax year, the answer from the department, if they didn't have records in there, that they would be found noncompliant for that year. That terrifies me. Also, when this bill was written in the depths of the recession, I can assure you of the 20,000 licensees we had at that time, a number of them did not have any income for the year, hence why we're at just over 13,000 active licensees in our association now. So we've seen a significant drop off in our numbers for that. As Mr. Russell mentioned, making everyone who's compliant already demonstrate that they're already compliant rather than focusing on those who are not is concerning, especially as the real estate agency has switched to an electronic licensing system. You actually do not go in and submit paper copies of anything anymore. That's been a significant improvement that the agency is very proud of. I think this is almost taking a step back with what we're looking at with paper copies of things demonstrating your compliance, as well as, you know, people are waiting, not that I would ever do it with my law license, but waiting to the last possible minute to renew. Then lo and behold, you find out that the state has a IT glitch. I know that's never happened before, but perhaps if the website were not functioning, you'd be in significant harm for your profession. Obviously, we're also concerned about what this would cost to each agency to start complying with this in addition, rather than just the limited pilot project. I think to quote the chair, big bite, not quite ready, perhaps. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB. And as this bill, many issues that have already been mentioned, I will say that it's very troubling to our NFIB members. We've been discussing this bill for several years now. And some of the issues that we have is in reference to the material that was provided, I think it was in September 2012, and I will say I have an error in this, referring it to HB 3082 at the time, and I think that was the wrong bill number, so I will correct it with the bill with the correct bill number following today's testimony. But during that project interview, it was reported that 97% of the individuals that were in the study were compliant. So we're talking about a 3% non-compliant, which is relatively small out of 6,596 licensees that were used in the project. The other part of that that was brought up is that of the 6,596 individuals that was used in this project, that there was about 48% of them that they could not even subjectively identify to be used in this study because of issues such as licensees were out-of-state licensees, possible non-filers, licensee registered with board under one name but filing returns under a different name, licensee no longer doing business in Oregon, etc. And I think that this also further demonstrates the complexity of this issue and how it could have adverse effects on businesses that are required to have one or more licenses and whose employees also are needed to have licenses. And so this is a very troubling issue for us. It also would set up a new state technology has already been mentioned, although they're going in that direction. We're talking about a very expensive and expansive requirement technology and system that would be on the backs of taxpayers. And it would require agencies, boards, and commissions to revoke or suspend licenses of those deemed not to be tax compliant. And that, of course, would make it even more difficult for the taxpayer to pay back licenses if, in fact, it was found that they needed to pay back taxes. It also was said in testimony in previous sessions that the Oregon Department of Revenue, at their disposal already today, they have the authority to go in to businesses that are non-compliant on their taxes and put pressure on them right up to the point of causing them to close their doors. So there's where we have focused tax compliance on that 3% that are not compliant, instead of creating a burden of administrative burden on small businesses having to get their tax compliance, and if there's any hiccups, their business is threatened, and also the same with their employees. So for this and many reasons, and was also stated, this is not ready for prime time yet, and it has a lot of issues that are very, very troubling for our small businesses. And with that, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is, I suppose, let's assume we know the, some of, we'll use a real estate person since we have.
Blasphemy.
So this person hasn't paid their taxes. The department knows about it. This law passes, let's say it applies to that person. So now they get a notice saying the department always knew you weren't paying your taxes, but now we have this additional lever. We're going to take away your license. The department does have the opportunity to already pursue that person for not having filed. Is that correct? What I'm trying to get at here is what's just happened, because when we had these discussions before, I was trying to figure out what we had done on this broad scale that we didn't already have, which is the power to chase people down with our audit procedures. What is it that this truly adds? Is it just that additional club to hit people over the head with and say, we're not going to let you sell real estate, in addition to the fact that we can pursue you with our audit process? I'm trying to figure out what, from your view, what are you going to tell the folks that you represent just happened?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think without this bill, you can do exactly what you're talking about already. If the department knows that an individual is not compliant, they can require that they come into compliance. They actually have the right to go to the agency and say, cut this person off. What we're more concerned about is the bill flips it completely over and says, basically, you're guilty until proven innocent. So every single person has to demonstrate compliance before they can have their license issued. It's a very different situation than we currently have. One slide that I remember from, I think it was maybe 13, but it might have even been 2010 when we got the first update on it, was they found the most effective method that the department had to get people into compliance was sending them a letter at the time of renewal of their license. That was all it was. No bigger hammer than that, but just saying, by the way, we know that you're not compliant. And that was the tool that they found most effective. And so at that point in time, I had assumed that we had found the silver bullet of what we should be doing for relatively little cost. It seems like we continue to try and expand it to all licensees, whether to prove that they're compliant up front rather than the reverse. Did that answer your question, Mr. Vice Chair?
Did follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please, yeah.
So, but I'm still trying to get back to where I was on this, because this is the third or fourth time we've had this discussion, and I apologize for not remembering exactly what level of debate we reached the last time, but it seems to me that the question was, were we going to say to people, we're going to take away your privilege of selling real estate until you get busy and pay your taxes? That was what I, that's not what I think is being said by those that support the bill. But I may have it wrong. I do agree it does flip it, but
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think there's a significant difference in what we originally had drafted as well that's been pointed out compared to the bill now. The way we had it drafted, the commission itself could look and say, okay, are you doing the right step sort of thing. It was a may suspend the license. This has changed to shall. So now there's no discretion for the individual licensing board to say you are. I think we were pretty clear, as Representative Reed pointed out, of what we were looking at, because the way the bill was originally drafted in 2009, if you were behind on a payment plan, that was it. You lost your license. I mean, any sort of noncompliance. So we tried to glean that out a little bit more in the language that's in the current iteration of the law to say, you know, if you're in a payment plan, you got to be delinquent by more than X days and things like that to try and get what you're at. But our original concern, getting back to your question, Mr. Vice Chair, was and Jan mentioned a little bit too, it's concerning that you're going to take away the person's ability to make a living when you expect them to pay back money. But that, I think that ship has sailed already. I mean, we've put this pilot project in place, and the department has other mechanisms to do exactly that.
Yeah, please.
Right. I think it's coming back to me. And I think I said it before my previous question, and that is, we are basically saying, if we adopt this approach, in addition to the tools we already have, knowing full well you haven't paid your taxes and we could come after you and chase you down, we also now will have the power to take away your whatever you're doing with your license. So what we're really doing, and in the fear of that threat may prompt more people to pay, but at its heart, it's our having that additional power to take things away from those who don't pay their taxes. In this case, their ability to practice law or sell real estate or cut hair or serve beer or whatever the case may be, drive truck. That's what we just did. I just want to get the finest point on it I can get.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, the department currently has that authority without this bill.
Let me follow up on that.
Yes, please.
I'm not sure how it does. How can it take away someone's license?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll have to get you the particular statute because I'm remembering off the top of my head from this discussion over the last 6 years. But the department did have for people who are delinquent on their taxes significantly the ability. Now, whether or not they exercise that ability to revoke licenses is a whole other decision. And
I think the department would like to weigh in on that question, and I think we'll let them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue again. And we do have authority to request a licensing agency to suspend a license for non-payment of taxes. It's in 305-385. And we don't have the authority to suspend the license. We have to ask the licensing agency to do so based on our information. And it's after all collection efforts have expired. We've exhausted everything. It's a last-ditch effort to gain compliance with this person. Does that help?
Well, I'm wondering, can you give us an idea of how useful that tool has been, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, I could get specific stats because it is something that we track, but I think annually we ask for suspension probably less than a dozen or so. And I think that the most response we get from people is the notice of intent to suspend. We send a letter saying, look, we're at our last effort here, and we're going to ask your licensing agency to suspend. Now, of course, I do not believe that we have the authority to ask the state bar or the licensing agency for attorneys to suspend their licenses.
I just got a smile from over here.
Let's keep that where it is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vince, does that answer your question?
I'm very happy. Yeah, I'm kind of. Yes, yeah, it does. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it
does. All right. Representative Smith Warner.
Yes, I had just wanted to clarify that I think it's an extremely significant policy priority that indeed the state has the right, if not the obligation, to say if we are licensing you to work in this state, you need to fulfill your end of the bargain and pay your taxes. And so I'm it's very interesting to hear the back and forth about the whether you go out that proactively or reactively. And I just want to say that I think that is an unquestionable right and even obligation of the state. If you're going to do business in the state, you need to participate by paying taxes, paying for the services that you are providing, that you are receiving in the state.
So. And Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, we don't disagree with you on that. It's just the method about which we go about it, which I honestly feel like we're rehashing a little bit of the very first testimony on the bill, and hence why I worked with Representative Reed to figure out kind of what we could look at as far as a pilot project.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'm looking at the statute that the department referred to, 305.385, and note that it says, upon the receipt of such a notice, the agency shall refuse to reissue, renew, or extend any license, contract, or agreement until the agency receives a certificate issued by the department that the person is in good standing with respect to any returns due and taxes payable to the department as of the date of the certificate. Now, the statute is much longer than that, and I'd refer people who want to look at it to that statute. I suspect that with the new core system, they may find themselves in a position to deal with more than a dozen of these a year. It's simply a guess on my part. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2164, open a public hearing on House Bill 2103. Oh, yes. Good. Oh, you're still here. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2103 comes to you from a recommendation from a report by the Department of Revenue on out-of-state tax shelters. What the bill does is it codifies in Oregon statute the notion of economic substance. The doctrine of economic substance has been around for decades and has been used at the federal level. For many years, though, the courts, there were different interpretations of how to apply the concept of economic substance. And due to this differing treatment at the federal level, in 2010, Congress codified how the doctrine was to be applied. And in current law, there is a two-part conjunctive test for the notion of economic substance. And basically, the taxpayer has to demonstrate that their economic position is improved by the transactions, basically that they're making profit from those transactions, and that the transactions have a substantial non-tax business purpose. It was basically getting at some sham transactions that were being done purely to manipulate tax liability, that there was no economic reason behind them. And part of that codification in the federal law in 2010 was just how the economic substance doctrine was to be applied, not when it was to be applied, just if it's going to be applied, this is how it will be applied, and that was that two-part conjunctive test. So the bill before you, and so since 2010, some states have been codifying that concept into their own statutes. Unfortunately, I don't have statistics right now as to how many states have done that, but what the bill before you does is codify that concept in Oregon statute, or it would codify that concept in Oregon statute.
Okay. And that, this was introduced by the interim committee.
Yes, in 2014, I guess for new members, in 2014, the Department of Revenue presented a report on out-of-state tax shelters that was required by the 2013 legislation. And that report had, I think, three recommendations, and this is one of those recommendations for future legislation, and this is one of those recommendations.
Okay, and I think that report is attached, isn't it?
It is in all
the states. It's in the meeting materials for this hearing. Does the department want to be heard on this one?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative, what's it?
Could you give an example of a sham that you're talking about, just something that we might all understand?
I think the Department of Revenue could do a better job of a specific example.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe DiNicola, Oregon Department of Revenue. And as explained by Chris, or LRO, this bill does follow up on a recommendation from our 2014 report on out-of-state tax shelters. And this was really intended to address transactions involving related entities. Think of large multinational, multi-state corporations that have the ability to shift assets, enter into transactions with a related entity in order to avoid taxation in our state. And the concept of economic substance is this is a long-standing doctrine. It goes back to the 1930s under the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision Gregory, and it has been addressed over the decades at the federal level and by states. And as Paul mentioned, I'm sorry, as Chris mentioned, in 2010, the IRS did adopt IRC 77, or that is, Congress enacted 7701 of the Internal Revenue Code, which codified that this is a two-part conjunctive test. That is, in order for a disputed transaction to be recognized, the taxpayer has to demonstrate that the transaction had a motive, that is, the taxpayer had a motive beyond tax avoidance or tax minimization to enter into the transaction. And second, that there was some economic benefit other than tax minimization or tax avoidance. If the taxpayer does not meet those two tests, then the transaction is disallowed. And that is the intent of what we're doing here. There have been jurisdictions around the country that have viewed the test as disjunctive rather than conjunctive. That is, in some jurisdictions, they would apply these as two independent tests. So it would be sufficient for a taxpayer to merely assert a motive. They might have a motive to enter into a transaction with a related party, but there is still no economic substance, no benefit other than tax minimization. So we are making it clear, that is, this bill would make it clear that Oregon adopts the same standard as adopted at the federal level and by other jurisdictions, that the two-part test must be met for a transaction to be allowable.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your testimony. It's really fascinating. It just strikes me that the test, and I'm reading the report, the test itself almost begs the question, because there's many instances where business transactions, and I'm thinking even the first business transaction that a company may enter into by selecting to be a limited liability company, a partnership, a corporation, could be done largely, if not exclusively, for tax purposes, apart from the sort of business purpose of the enterprise. So I'm just raising the question of what factors has the court laid down, or what factors do we look at for whether or not there's a non-tax business purpose for entering into a transaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, it might be best illustrated by an example.
Yeah.
We have had examples where a multi-state taxpayer may take an asset, let's say an intangible asset, and transfer that asset to another entity, a related entity in another state, and the income that's generated from that asset could then escape Oregon taxation. You know, this is not taking advantage of a tax credit or some form of business organization. As you've mentioned, forming a limited liability company is certainly unacceptable, and would not be subject to dispute.
Yeah.
We're really talking about transactions that are entered into solely for the purpose of shifting that income out of this jurisdiction to another related entity, and that is the purpose.
Follow up. I understand the purpose. Again, I'm almost begging the question because so many transactions that all of us engage in from time to time are maybe if not solely for the purpose, but largely for the purpose, and some instances almost seemingly for the purpose of reducing a tax bill. So how to draw that line is just an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, this certainly would not apply to a taxpayer, let's say, who is taking advantage of a statutory tax credit. Certainly right. That's entered into potentially for the motivation of reducing taxes, taking advantage of some provision of our tax law. It would not encompass those types of transactions.
Mm-hmm. Sure. One more clarifying question.
Yes.
Has the Supreme Court's test, is it now considered Oregon's common law for our tax structure, or would we be required to adopt this statute to have the standard? Are we just codifying something that's already in common law now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, not speaking as an attorney, but again, although this is a provision currently since 2010 in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 7701, it is somewhat of a gray area whether Oregon would adopt that as part of our general tie to federal tax law. So the purpose of this bill would then be to clarify that in fact the same test that is being applied at the federal level is being applied by Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think Davis asked the question. I'll ask it again, I guess, a different way. You mentioned that surely no one would question someone who bought a tax credit. Yeah. But why is that? Why not? Tell me the reason why. I'm looking at the standard here. The transaction has economic substance beyond tax benefits and a non-tax purpose for doing it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I believe we'd look to the case law in this area, and I believe it's well established that taking advantage of a provision that is enacted specifically for the purpose of allowing a tax reduction if a taxpayer enters into those transactions, those are allowed by statute. I believe the case law would tell us that this doctrine would not apply in those circumstances.
The substance certainly applies to the person who is selling the tax credit, because they're going to engage in some business activity that they wouldn't otherwise engage in, one presumes.
One presumes.
Well, assuming the credits was adopted appropriately and providently and not by error by the legislature, which of course is the thing I think about all the time.
Well, if maybe, Mr. Chair, let's assume we stack the tax credits and they added up to enough to actually make us money. Would that be violative of this? Because we're only doing it because of the tax credits, because they make us money. Mm-hmm. So that's my question, is that does that violate this?
Add a federal tax credit together with a state tax credit,
and a few more
together with
that,
a few other things, and end up with 110%.
Exactly.
Right. Good question. But I think your position is the same, isn't it, that that's covered by an exception that is built in by case law?
Mr. Chair, again, I'm not aware of any jurisdiction that would have applied the test to a legislatively granted tax credit.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. You know what I really appreciate about the recommendation that is set forth in the report is that it gets at the fundamental issue, which is we're trying to make sure that taxpayers are paying their fair share toward the services, the public services that they receive. And I think we would all acknowledge that our tax structure is in some ways Byzantine and hard to apply in ways that everyone would consider sensible. And it's always appropriate, I think, for the legislature to take a look at ways that we can make our tax structure more sensible, make sure that people can't take money out of this hand, put it in this hand, put it in this pocket, in this pocket, and as a result, never have, you know, money at the right place at the right time to pay taxes, when fundamentally what we really know is, you know, we have schools that need funding, we have roads that need to be developed, we have libraries that need to operate, and all kinds of public services that require that every taxpayer pays a fair amount. And to the extent your recommendation helps take away a little bit of the confusion that's in our current law by transposing a long-established federal principle and clearly manifesting it in Oregon law so everyone can do can follow the rules that I'm sure we all intend to follow anyway, but sometimes it can be very confusing what the rules are. I think that that's a step in the right direction, and I'm really excited that you've brought this forward to us today.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Mr. Russell wants to be heard on this bill as well. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2103? Mr. Russell.
Again, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'll be very brief because you were getting at my issue. You may recall last week we were talking about the Conway case, and Conway was purchasing Betsy tax credits, legitimately so. It was authorized under Oregon statutes, and then they were using that to reduce their tax liability. I think that case clearly is described in this bill. Because there was no other purpose for them to purchase those tax credits than to reduce their tax liability. The public purpose of allowing tax credits to be sold in that particular case was so that people that were building projects that qualified for the Betsy, they could get the money up front to invest in the project instead of having to wait to take them as a tax credit off of their income tax return. So both parties benefited from the policy. It's clearly authorized in state law. And the way I read this bill, certainly it could be a taxpayer like Conway, Department of Revenue could decline to accept that as a legitimate transaction, which I think it is. So I was glad to hear the Department of Revenue say that tax credits, authorized state tax credits, were not covered, but perhaps it would be comforting if there was something in the bill that specifically excluded state authorized tax credits.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Russell? Thank you, sir. Busy afternoon. All right. I'm sorry. Are there comments? Questions?
I just have a question. When we exclude something out of it, whether we agree with it or not, does this make a separate class? I mean, I'm not seeing a fairness in this in particular if we exclude certain things. Credits or whatever, certain ability for some companies to do this under state law. I mean, how does this serve our state and the revenue for our state if we have different sets or subsets of people that have to pay taxes for one reason versus another? I mean,
Representative Eilinger, do you want to try that one?
Well, I would just echo what I hear Representative Whitsitt saying and say that, you know, I think as a matter of public policy, it's appropriate to have a corporate minimum tax be a corporate minimum tax and that a person cannot actually buy down below it. So in that regard, I would say I think that we should eliminate any confusion or inconsistency by establishing that a corporate minimum tax is what it is and you can't buy yourself below it.
Yeah, the comment that I would make is that all around the country, states have different ways in which they tax in order to operate state and local services, whatever those are. And every state's different from every other state. There's nobody who has exactly the same system, state tax system, as any other state in the country. So there are at least 50 unique, probably 51, aren't there, unique systems all around the country. And if as a business, I have the capacity to establish a subcorporation in a state that will not tax my my royalty income if I have all of my trademarks and my intellectual property in that state, and I pay a royalty to that essentially dummy company, I can reduce my taxes in another state where that would simply be considered income to be taxed. For example, a state that doesn't have any income tax. That would be one way it works, and of course, that's what we're talking about when we're dealing with the tax haven countries, is that kind of issue is what we're talking about. And the bill, as I understand it, simply says if you got a good reason, business reason, for doing what you're doing, then the fact that it might save you some taxes, too, it doesn't matter. But if you're doing it merely for the purpose of saving taxes, then you're going to have to pay those taxes anyway. Does that make it simple for us? No, it doesn't. But I think that's the reason for why they would propose a bill like this. Please, go. Yes.
I just want to say for the record, I don't want to take anything away from somebody who's already got something. I mean, right. that wasn't the point. I just was trying to understand going forward.
Right.
I tend to agree with Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Anything else on the public hearing on House Bill 2103? If not, we'll close the public hearing. Paul, I think we've exhausted our agenda, have we not? Colleagues, see you all tomorrow. With that, the committee's adjourned.